This is episode 17 of the Being Seen podcast. My guest is Dr. Michelle Druin, Intimacy Famine and Being Seen.
To feel seen is next to feeling like you belong, maybe the most significant part of living a life, to feel like you were seen in this world, because we exist in this infinitesimally small piece of time on the time continuum. So that someone sees you and really sees you is just so meaningful. So to me, it means everything. When I saw the name of your podcast, I thought, perfect.
You are listening to the Being Seen podcast, where Jenny Q gives you the resources to get unstuck. Join us every week as Jenny introduces you to a wealth of voices who share their own being seen moments, along with tips, tricks, and insights. With a story full of real-life experiences, Jenny Q is holding your hand as you go in search of your own being seen moment, because you can live your best life despite the pain of the past or uncertainty in the future. In fact, it may actually be your superpower. And now your host, Jenny Q.
Michelle Druin, PhD, is a professor of psychology and senior research scientist who conducts research on sexuality, interpersonal relationships, and technology. After more than 15 years of studying people and the way they interact with each other, Michelle has put a lot of that information into one fun book. In this episode, we cover many of the topics, such as how the intimacy famine is not new due to the pandemic, how social media isn't all bad, and specific things you can do if you're feeling a lack of intimacy. Dr. Druin's new book, Out of Touch, How to Survive an Intimacy Famine, is available for pre-order anywhere you buy books. And now, welcome to my guest, Dr. Michelle Druin. Well, one of the things that we know for sure that has happened during the pandemic is an intimacy famine. And I'm excited to have you here, Michelle, to talk about an intimacy famine. And it isn't just because of the pandemic. In fact, it's so pervasive that you've written a book about it that will be released soon. And welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here. You know, we've missed each other several times and meeting personally, so I'm grateful to finally be here with you.
Well, likewise, I've been watching your journey on social media and all of the amazing research that you've done. In fact, if I remember right, I remember being really surprised because you were so on top of it when the pandemic hit. You sent out help me out here. It was a research poll or something like that.
Yeah, I had done some research pretty early on in the pandemic about the ways that people were using social media and how that was affecting their mental health. And our research team at the hospital actually got picked by the health commissioner here in Allen County to put out some messages. So I started blogging a lot. Actually, the blogging was a nice way for me to cope with my own feelings of loss during the pandemic and fears. It, you know, distraction like that can sometimes make a busy mind feel a little more calm.
Oh, for sure. One of the things that I learned through the pandemic was how even though I felt so evolved prior to the pandemic hitting, I regressed. And it was very common, right?
Of course. What kind of regression did you feel you experienced?
Well, for me, because, you know, I lost half my body weight and, you know, I used food and I had an eating disorder and I still have an eating disorder. For some reason, it didn't magically disappear just when I lost the weight. And so for me, I really used food for comfort and I regressed into that. And I just said, this is just what it is for the moment.
Yeah, I actually wrote something about that I wrote a blog post for Psychology Today. I'm one of their bloggers. And I wrote something on that topic exactly. What I said was people are looking for things, but they don't really know what they're looking for. So I think a lot of us found ourselves in front of a refrigerator or in front of the cabinet during the pandemic looking for something. And we thought it might be food, but the void we were trying to fill was probably much bigger. as is the case a lot of times with eating disorders, right? You're trying
Absolutely.
To fill a bigger void than what the food can actually fill. So one of the things I talk about in my book is wine sales went up something like 26% within a month. I mean, people started eating more, drinking more. A lot of people gained that pandemic weight because the times that we were usually busy and distracted, being industrious, were gone. And we were suddenly confined within our four walls with our own demons.
Well, of course. And what do you say to people who experience that, whether it was food or wine or Netflix binging or whatever it was that they used to fill that void? What do you say to them around the shame that comes from regressing?
So one of the things that I need to say is that I don't see patients. So I'm a research psychologist So I don't usually counsel people. I'm not qualified to counsel anyone. But what I will say I've certainly addressed in my book is just this idea that as we're heading out of the pandemic, and whether or not we're truly out or not, I'm not sure yet. Time will tell. But even as we've gotten more freedom from the social isolation that really kept us pinned inside and many of us out of our normal daily lives for a while, we certainly have seen a shift in that. But as we come out, we just have to acknowledge that there have been all kinds of losses. Some of us have had really big, tangible losses. We've lost people. We've lost jobs. We've lost things that we love. And then others of us, our losses are a little less tangible. And some of those losses will be the losses of control that we felt we had over our lives before the pandemic hit. So what I would suggest, and what I have suggested in the book, is just we just give ourselves grace. We just went through something that no one could have predicted. No one in our lifespans have ever gone through that before. And we just have to accept that we did regress a little bit and maybe try to let go of the guilt, understand that that was a natural reaction to a severe stress, a severe social isolation, and then try to make baby steps to recover a life that we are proud of.
I love that. I really love that. One of my strong beliefs is I believe that lasting transformation begins with self-healing, self-acceptance, self-grace, right? We have to get to that place where we can heal inside before we can transform. I think one of the mistakes that we make is trying to force the transformation from outside in. And if we don't make that internal transformation, then I think we keep getting stuck and stuck and stuck. And so I really love that you brought up grace. I want to go back to intimacy, because I know that, I mean, how to survive an intimacy famine is just such a fascinating idea. And that is what your entire book is about. Can we have you talk about just defining intimacy? Because I think a lot of us automatically go to physical or sexual, you know, intimacy. And I want you to define what intimacy is and what it all encompasses.
Yeah. So I actually just was addressing this today as I was making various pitches for different news outlets. And the way I began was to talk about how, as psychologists, definitions are hard for us. There's something called an operational definition, which says that we define things by how they're measured. And that helps guide us when we're trying to relate things, concepts like intimacy, to other concepts like attachment, for example. And one of the things I had said today as I was writing out these pitches was that I often get stuck in rabbit holes trying to figure out what are the different definitions. And one of those rabbit holes I got stuck in about a year ago was about love. So it started with a piece I'd read about Fyodor Dostoevsky and his conceptualization of love. I love the Russian authors. Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, just give me all of them. I once heard someone say that the French think they know love, but the Russians, they really know love, because they show all types of love. They show romantic love and the love between family members. And then there's the pain that love can bring and loss. And they just really show the whole gamut of love. Anyway, so 20 philosophers and about 2 hours later, I had read all of these different concepts of love. And romantic love, from a scientific perspective, is comprised of usually three traits. There's usually a triarchic theory that is probably the most common theory of love. Dr. Sternberg, actually at Cornell University, which is where I went, he composed this theory, and it says that we have passion, which is the fire, the heat, that intense desire we feel for other people. We have commitment, which helps us stay devoted to an individual for a period of time. And then we have intimacy. And from that triarchic perspective, intimacy is sharing feelings with someone. And so much so that you feel warmth towards the other person. But it's just like a closeness and a sharing. Now, intimacy outside of that metaphorical triangle has a much broader definition. And you could get lost in that rabbit hole just as easily as you could get lost in the rabbit hole of love that I fell down. So, but intimacy, like you said, Jennifer, is often when people think of it, they think of sex. They think, you know, sexual intercourse or whatever variation of sex, and our physical bodies touching in some sexual way, and maybe even just physical intimacy, holding hands or hugs. But there are actual several kinds of intimacy. There's intellectual intimacy, you know, sharing debates about philosophical topics. What we're doing right now, you know, would be intellectual intimacy. We are learning to know each other in a way that challenges our minds and reflects our knowledge and our views of the world. There are types of social intimacy, the things we share with other people, the types of things that we do with other people. There's even spiritual intimacy, you know, the feelings that we feel towards others in our spiritual journeys. So aside from sexual touch, there are many different types of intimacy.
Just hearing you describe that puts so much clarity on why relationships are so complicated. It is so challenging when you're experiencing a specific type of intimacy. Let's go with spiritual, right? How common is it for people to mistake that for a different type of intimacy that maybe they would want to build a whole, you know, romantic relationship on? And it's not necessarily, or is it? Or is it? Is that enough? I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, as you were saying it, I wondered, is that enough? If I can find some type of intimacy with someone, maybe that is enough to sustain a commitment to them over time. There's nothing concrete written about why relationships last. We do know that there are some things that will predict the longevity of a relationship. Communication skills are some of them. How people manage conflict, some of their personal traits, how alike people are sometimes predicts longevity. But it's not like something like spiritual intimacy is more important than sexual intimacy or the reverse. So yeah, relationships are complex. Some people want different types of intimacy. To you, maybe spiritual intimacy is important. To another person, it may not even factor into how they choose to find a mate or choose someone to love. So it's highly variable across cultures and across individuals within those cultures.
That is, I'm going to be thinking about that for, I'm certain, weeks, about the different types of intimacy, because I hadn't really considered all the different, and I'm sure there's even more listed in your book, like, you know, of how many different types of intimacy. I want to jump back now to how we use social media to fill an intimacy void and how that works.
I wouldn't even say it's a void.
Okay.
I would say social media has evolved to meet our social needs. If not for our demand, the supply would not exist. We want to touch other people in emotionally, intellectually, socially. We want to fill our own goals about who we are and what we want to be. And social media and technology in general has given us a vehicle to do that in a way that's easy, mostly immediate, can reach millions of people. You can more easily find your people than you can if you canvass your neighborhood, because people congregate in groups surrounded by topical areas, surrounded by, you know, the natural groupings that you might choose if you had your choice of every grouping in the world, right? So I would say that it doesn't fill a void. What I would say is it is a route to the development of intimacy. Now, some types of intimacy, right? There will be some types of intimacy that you can have and others that you're sacrificing by connecting with people via social media. Right now, I'm getting to know you and that feels really good for me. I actually really enjoy getting to know people. I actually think that the journey of a well-lived life will necessarily mean that you've felt very connected to other humans. I think that that, for me, will be the shaping of my life and me feeling like I lived a good life when it comes to the end. So this right now is my favorite thing, getting to know you, talking to you. But if we were together, maybe I would hand you a cup of tea and I'd be looking into your eyes and maybe I would, you know, touch your hand, which is the pretty much the most appropriate place to touch a stranger across cultures.
Right.
But it might allow us for other kinds of intimacy that might draw us closer than if we're having this conversation as we are right now. But even this video call is a little bit better than us having a phone call or us texting each other. Because, you know, you and I have corresponded before, but I definitely feel closer to you right now, looking at your face and seeing you move in this world than I ever would have had we had just, you know, text-based conversations. So anyway, that was a long answer to a very basic question. I don't think it's necessarily filling gaps. What it's doing is opening up a world for us that is a natural extension of our social world. There's no offline life and online life. It's all just life.
Yes, yes, yes. So much yes. I love that. And I want to come back to how people kind of, I mean, I think a lot of people become addicted to social media with the dopamine hits. And how do we know that it's kind of maybe going, you know, over the top, that we should rein it back in? But before we get there, I want to share, as you were talking about the connection, it reminded me of my own journey through social media. It was 2008 and I was just watching the news, right? So think back, 2008, like, you know, social media, like digital marketing mostly was, I mean, MySpace was around, but other than that, it was websites and blogs and, you know, just kind of general stuff. And then I was watching the news and CNN and Rick Sanchez said, "Tell me your thoughts, tweet me at Rick Sanchez, CNN. And I went, I want to tell him what I'm thinking about. I didn't know what he was talking about though. So I opened my laptop and I typed into whatever search engine I was using and said, "What is a tweet?" And then I found Twitter and then I logged in and then I sent him a tweet and he did not respond, by the way. But that's not the point. The point is what I saw was people making real connection. And I was fascinated at how people were connecting with each other, interacting, having conversations, actually conducting business in 140 characters or less. And I think that's what you're talking about. It was fascinating. And then I experienced the same thing with live streaming in Periscope in 2015. You know, it took it up a level, just like you said, it was video. It wasn't just all, you know, typing and you know, sharing messages that way. And so I really can see exactly how that applies, how it is connection, it is intimacy. So what goes wrong when people become addicted, and how do we know if we're addicted?
So let's tackle your second question first. How
okay,
do you know
okay,
if you're addicted?
Okay, sure.
So I'll go and speak and I will ask people, how many of you are addicted to your phones? And they'll raise their hands. They know. About half of the audience is always raising their hands. I don't need to run you through any kind of complicated questionnaire. If you think you're addicted to your phone, you're addicted to your phone. Part of addiction, from any perspective, is that you can't be without the substance. You're relying upon it. When you don't have it, you're anxious. You have some kind of effect. It may not be anxiety. It might be something else. And it's something that could disrupt your life, right? It's something that is probably disrupting your life, your use of that. And I think regardless of where I am, about half of the people there will say, yeah, I'm addicted.
That's fascinating.
So addiction is actually quite common. I remember years ago, there was a study in Britain where they called something nomophobia. So being afraid to be without your phone, nomophobia. So for people who got nervous that they were going to lose battery. Some people won't even travel to places if they know that there won't be a cell phone signal. Those things all might signify nomophobia. And although a lot of people are addicted, very few of them are seeking treatment for that addiction. So how much does it actually disrupt your life? I mean, I think our phones have become such a major player in all of our social interactions that addiction, or what we perceive as addiction, has become very commonplace. But those treatment centers are opening up. People are seeking treatment for tech addiction and, you know, being addicted to their phones. So where did we go wrong, I think, was the first question. And I mean, the stance I take in my book is that we haven't really gone wrong, right? A phone is the ultimate social facilitator. And your examples were actually really good. You probably don't know, but you're stepping into right into the premise of my book, which says that we don't have to view this as, like it or not, we're here, the train has left the station, tech is here, and we have to deal with it. My stance is far more positive. We have a chance to harness what I think is incredible technology in order to facilitate social relationships in ways that are unprecedented in human history. I grew up with encyclopedias, and you may have as well, in a television that had 3 channels and a landline. My ability to connect with others, to look up information, to conduct my work while I'm in a plane, which is where I do a lot of my best work because I do travel a lot, is incredible. It's opening doors for my own self-improvement and connection with others because I can collaborate with people even while I'm in a plane flying over an ocean. I have Wi-Fi on the plane. I can send them messages. We can work together in some kind of Google Doc or send each other documents back and forth. So it's pretty incredible what this technology allows us to do. We are both infovores by our nature, meaning we want information, and we are also social beings. We need social connection and a sense of belongingness just above our very basic needs like food, water, security. Bam. Next thing is social needs. So I'm not convinced that we're going wrong. That said, you did bring up these tiny hits of dopamine. Okay. So yeah. So this has gotten a lot of attention, and I definitely mention it in my book, but because you and I right now are not meeting face-to-face, we are missing out on the potential for these floods of oxytocin that might happen when we are physically close to the people with whom we're developing or nurturing our social bonds. And instead of having that, we have more of those interactions on social media where someone likes our thing, comments on our thing, and we get these little tiny hits of dopamine, and those keep us hooked. Right? It's like a little game that you're playing, and it's like a slot machine that's always giving a little win. And so you stay at that slot machine because it's a big, you know, you're getting reinforced every single time you pull this trigger. But what you're missing out on is the windfall, right? You don't have the chance when you're just getting these little wins of having the big win. And I think that is changing who we are as humans. And as a person who's focused on human development, I do wonder what that means about who we become. And I also think it's imperative that we start to harness the technology so that we can get more deep and meaningful connection out of this than these little dopamine hits.
Wow. Okay. Okay, fascinating. What I'm wondering now, as technology continues to evolve, right? And we continue to want to interact virtually, have you had a chance to either participate or research the effect of the virtual space, the metaverse, something like spatial.io, where you go in, you create an avatar, it creepily looks like you, but it's not you. And you're walking around and you're engaging with people who creepily look like them, but that's not them, right? And that's where the technology is at this moment. I'm sure it's going to evolve to the point where the avatar looks a lot more like us. But have you had a chance to research the effects in that arena or even experience it?
I have not. I have been watching very carefully as Mitch Jackson has been posting some of those things. So my knowledge of this is limited to what Mitch has posted. I've been really fascinated in it. I haven't done any research in that area, but I do have some research in other types of AI and how those are affecting our social lives. I mean, as more robotics are being integrated into our human experience, we are, because we're social beings, naturally trying to make these more social. We're anthropomorphizing our robotic beings so they look more human. We are exploring whether or not touching a robot, getting touch from a robot, has positive effects on us like human touch does. Does it lower cortisol levels? Does it, you know, decrease your heart rate like it would if you were touching a human being? We are exploring in, and I say me, it's not me, but I am interested in the people who are exploring this, but we are exploring the ways in which these technologies can be harnessed to make us feel more connected. I think we are getting there. The metaverse offers a really unique opportunity to take a leap into different types of connection that may be more integral as our world is becoming less touch-based. So maybe these will help replace some of the oxytocin that I think we might be missing from those physical face-to-face interactions.
It's mind-blowing. Like, that's just mind-blowing.
Well, I hope so. Well, I don't know. Will it be mind-blowing? We'll know. We'll see.
Yeah.
Just because the tech always advances before the research can catch up. It precedes the research. So we see the tech come and they may see it, you know, far before we do because they have these innovations in mind for years. But then we scramble to study the effects on humans. And I think that's part of the problem, right? Part of the problem is that everything emerged and then we scrambled to try to figure out what effects it's having on us. And so a lot of the negative attention is being directed at these tech companies and saying, you know, why didn't you help us? Why didn't you save us? Why didn't you predict this? Well, it's because we're now studying it. We're now catching up, right? But many of the things that we're finding, I think, are also kind of intuitive. So we are wanting, and we both want it. It's the classic approach avoidance conflict. We both want it and we don't want it. If we really didn't want it, then we wouldn't have Apple and, you know, Google and Amazon ruling the world. Like if we really didn't want it, they wouldn't.
I mean, that's just logical, right? That's just completely logical.
Just,
yeah.
It is. It's just straight business.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. For sure. So I want to find out from your research, like if you could even, I know that people really will get a lot more from reading your book, but I wonder if you could share like maybe three ways that people can get more intimacy if they're feeling like they need more intimacy, if they're in an intimacy famine, what your research shows. But before we get there, I am literally chomping at the bit to ask you this, okay? With the podcast name Being Seen, I have two questions for you. So now I'm just lining you up. I've got three things I want from you right now.
I love it. I love this.
So the first one is, when you heard the podcast name Being Seen, with your background and all of your research, and especially now with your new book on an intimacy famine, what did you think Being Seen meant?
This is such a great question. And you just don't realize how well-timed it is. So for a couple of months, I've been saying, because I do travel a lot, that one of my desires has been to walk through an airport And I see lots of people, you know, bustling back and forth. And I look at them and I usually listen to music while I go through. And that music is happy music that makes me feel connected. I love music as a powerful motivator for connection.
That makes two of us. I love it. Yes.
Okay. So I'm listening to music and I'm walking through an airport and I might be moving my arms or, you know, I love to just feel connected to the earth. And sometimes I look at these people bustling back and forth and I think, I want to stop and say to this person, I see you. I see you. And I said it to a friend of mine. I said, you know, I would love to do this. And he said, don't do that. They're going to think you're part of some kind of strange organization. You're going to confuse them forever. You're going to walk by. They will just be confused forever. And I'm like, yes, but it would mean so much to me for someone to come up to me and say, you, I see you.
Especially in an airport.
Yeah. You are not just a random person who's walking through this world who is unseen. I see you. So, but here's even better timing. Before I spoke to you tonight, I was on the phone with my sister who just finished her second book. She hasn't sent, they're both fiction. She hasn't sent them out yet for review, but she did NaNoWriMo, which is the National November Writing Month, where you write a book in a month. And she read me her first chapter about a psychologist who was giving a talk. And I was like, interesting. And at the end of that chapter, it said, I see you. And I said, you stole my thing. And she just laughed.
Wow.
But here you are. This conversation happened probably 30 minutes before we got on this call here. You don't know how much those words actually mean to me. Now you do. To be seen, to feel seen is next to feeling like you belong, maybe the most significant part of living a life, to feel like you were seen in this world, because we exist in this infinitesimally small piece of time on the time continuum. So that someone sees you and really sees you is just so meaningful. So to me, it means everything. When I saw the name of your podcast, I thought, perfect.
I love that. I love that story so much. And I want to know, and there's no right or wrong answer here, but I want to know if you can recall the first time that you ever felt seen.
Yes, I can. And this is going to take us way back. I'm lucky because I think I felt seen really young. And I think a lot of people go a long time in life before they feel like they're really seen. And so the fact that it happened when I was young actually set me on a trajectory that you'll see very clearly when I tell you about my moment. So one of the things that I am very open about, but we were really poor when we were young. My family was very chaotic. My stepfather was an alcoholic. So at some point in my life, we lived in a battered women's shelter and we had a very chaotic life. And one of the places that I always felt was somewhat of a refuge was school. And when I was in first grade, I remember being in a school and we moved from that town the next year because of the chaos. But that year, I remember the teacher standing in front of the class and saying, we're going to play a game called Around the World. And when she said it, I listened carefully and it was a flashcard game. So it was addition and subtraction flashcards. And the game was pretty simple. So the first person in the first seat would stand up and go to the person in the second seat. And then the teacher would flash the flashcard. The person who got it right would move on. The person who got it wrong would stay there. Or if the person who was moving got it wrong, they would sit in that desk. Okay. So if you got all the way around the classroom, beating every single person in the class, you will have gone what she termed around the world. And she said, if you do this, I'm going to take you to the Tasty Freeze and to get some ice cream. And I remember thinking, I want to win this. I really want to win this game. And so the very first time we played, I don't even remember where I was sitting in the order, but when it came to me, I won. I got my flashcard, and then I won the next one, and I won the next one, and one, and I went all the way around the classroom, and she kept the game going. So I went all the way around the classroom again. And then she stopped the game and she said, well, you went around the world twice. We're going to stop the game. And she's like, you won. We never played the game again. But she took me for ice cream, which I think, gosh, that would never happen today, right? That a teacher would be allowed to take a first grade child to get ice cream. And I remember she said to me, you can get anything you want. And I said, well, I would like a small strawberry sundae. And she said, you don't have to only get a small. You went around the world twice. You can get anything you want. And I said, I'd still just like a small strawberry sundae. But for the first time in my life, I felt like, oh, it's going to make me emotional. I felt like someone saw something in me that I didn't know existed before. And getting that recognition to just go for ice cream from this teacher made me feel like I had something special. I had something special to offer the world. And I know it might sound small, but then if you look at the rest of my path, you know, like I went to a public school. Again, we were really poor. And then I went to an Ivy League school for college. And then I went to Oxford for graduate school. And I believed in myself. She made me believe in myself. And that was a really special thing. And I really felt seen. And I've never even thought that that's the moment that made me feel seen. But when you asked it, it was just so clear that that was the moment.
For the listeners, we're both sitting here crying. thank you for sharing that. That is so powerful. And it is such a clear illustration on how important it is to see others. And I wonder if that's why you feel so moved when you're walking through a busy airport to just see people.
I mean, the point is that one thing that I've said often, and I think if I do another TED Talk, this will be it. There were so many things that people did along the way that they don't even realize how much it helped me on my path. I don't even know their names, you know, but someone came to me and they said something that changed my life, that made my life infinitely better. And those little moments, though, that village of people who gave me those moments have culminated into what I see as a happy and successful human being. I am so happy. I'm blissfully happy. I have a wonderful family. I have a career that I love. On every metric, I'm so thrilled with the life I have. And I hope that one day I could say something to someone that means as much to me as what those people did for me. You know, you may have the same experiences with the people who helped make you feel seen.
Well, very different. But one of the things that I say is what, as I'm learning even more by doing this podcast, is, you know what? All of our details might be different, but the shape is the same. It's amazing how similar our human experience is when we talk, when we share, when we open up, right? And so what I think about When you give credit to all those who helped you and all those who saw you and all those who encouraged you is how you've turned it around. And now you're putting all of the things that you've been given into helping other people. And this book is just one of the ways, right? One of the ways. And that brings us to that question that I set up with, are there three tips that you could give someone who feels like they're experiencing an intimacy famine as they're listening to this?
Yeah. So I will say that during the pandemic, many of us probably have felt this at one time or another. I felt a lack of intimacy. And intimacy can mean a connection to the outside world. You know, I have fewer connections that I'd want to have. The diversity of our social network is actually something that's a very strong indicator of our quality of life, our longevity, our ability to combat illness. The diversity of our social network matters a lot. So for some of us, a lack of intimacy might mean I don't have enough friends or social connections that I really feel are meaningful. For others of us, and these groups could be overlapping. The lack of intimacy we feel is much closer. It's with our closest connections. We don't feel as connected with them as we think we could. And there are discrepancies that exist in relationships that can really accentuate that. One example is a sexual desire discrepancy. Sexless marriages are incredibly common. As you get older, the frequency of sex usually declines for some biological reasons, but it's not only biological. Usually the couple dynamics and larger societal constructs that dictate sex roles about who's supposed to ask for sex and who's supposed to respond to sex can all be predictive of these discrepancies that we see in people's sexual desire. But sexual desires can be really hard, and discrepancies can be really hard to deal with in a relationship. People can feel rejected, disappointed, out of sync with their partner. So there are some very proximal feelings of lack of intimacy that could be affecting someone's life, and some more distal ones that affect more about the world. So let me give you one for the outside world first. So one tip I have is to talk to strangers. Like in an airport, like on an airplane, like on a bus. There are some great studies that have been done about people's expectations about what it'll be like to talk to a stranger and what it's actually like to talk to a stranger. You may not be surprised to know that people do not have high hopes that when they talk to strangers on a bus or on a train, that it will be an enjoyable experience. But when actually forced to do so, the people who are forced to have a conversation with a stranger have a way better time than people who are asked to do what they normally do, or people who are asked to think about something that they're supposed to do that day. So either of those tasks are not as enjoyable as talking to a stranger. We have false assumptions about what strangers can offer us. And I've experienced this myself on planes. You know, I've taken a lot of long plane rides, and I've met really fascinating people over my years of travel. And some of them have opened my eyes to the world in ways that it wouldn't have had I not had a conversation with that individual. It's so simple. You are literally trapped next to someone for an hour, 2 hours, 12 hours. It's the easiest thing. And we do want social connection.
So yeah, and you know what always surprises me about that situation is you have this amazing connection. You have this amazing conversation. And it could be, like you said, an hour, 2 hours, 4 hours. And it's not until you land, you're approaching, landing, and you're like, oh, by the way, my name's Jennifer.
Yeah, exactly. Because that's irrelevant. That who you are is not relevant. It's what you are. It's what your perspective is. It's what you say and how you make the other person feel. Our names, actually knowing who you are, is not a relevant part of that connection. Though, people have met spouses on planes, love interests on planes, like that has also happened, and friends on planes. So talking to strangers is definitely a good way to get some social stimulation, feel some intimacy, at least for a while, and if you want, continue that relationship. It is so easy now to connect via social media. You don't even have to give your phone number. At the end of a conversation, if you have a connection with an individual, you can say to them, hey, I'm on Instagram. I'm on Facebook. This is my name. You can contact me or not, but this has been amazing. And I'd love to keep in touch. That's
love
easy.
That. Love
it's
that.
Super easy.
And you can do it pandemic or no pandemic.
Exactly. Pandemic or no pandemic. In fact, it'll probably be easier post-pandemic because you'll be able to smile when you say it, right? We don't have the mask disguising our thing, but we can still smile with our eyes. But yes, that exchange of information can happen even if we're in masks forever on airplanes. Okay, so that was just one. Let's talk about one that's the more proximal. So desire discrepancies in a marriage. What do you do if you're there? So conversation is a key mechanism for getting over a variety of relationship woes. One of the critical mistakes that people make regarding this desire discrepancy is thinking that it's one person's fault. And my mom was married 3 times. She wasn't ever really good at relationships, but she said something to me one time that actually has saved my relationship on numerous occasions. And this is what it is. So this is advice from Grandma Judy.
Okay.
So she said, people injure each other in all kinds of ways in relationships. Some of those are really tangible and very salient. You can look at them and point to them and say, you did this. Other ways are more subtle. And it's hard to look at those and say, you did this. But there's sometimes of a collection of things that people do that can lead to someone feeling distanced, hurt, resentful. So when something big happens, you can look at that something big, but you should also look at the things that you might be doing, those other small things, those subtle things that might be contributing to the problem in the relationship. The perspective that's given me over time is that things don't happen in a bubble or a vacuum. If a relationship is a relationship, it's a two-way street. So if there is a sexless marriage, there's probably something about the interaction. It's not one person's fault. And there have even been position statements. There's a European sex society that came out with a position statement that said, this isn't just about one person or one person's biology. It's about the people in that relationship. So if you're having that desire discrepancy, communication, going to see a therapist, talking through your different feelings and what each person is doing that might be contributing to this difference in desire might be helpful. So one, talk to strangers. Two, have more open conversations and be open to the fact that the other partner not wanting to have sex is not just their problem, if that's an issue that you're facing.
Right. Well, and when you were describing that, right, I was thinking about different conversations, different examples where I was like, oh, yeah. I can see where that would have been a contributor, you know, even though it felt like it was the big thing was what about, but I also wonder, does that apply in other relationships as well? Friendships, business, colleagues, et cetera.
Oh yeah. Absolutely. Okay. It's not just romantic relationships. It's in every relationship. It's all a push-pull. There's a dynamic that exists. You do not exist in a bubble. The things that you do, you're receiving and putting out information into this world. So if something goes awry, it's not just someone else's fault. And that is a really good way to grow in this world, is for you to understand that things that go wrong, you should really just look, what is my contribution to this? And some things we just need to walk away from. Like, I don't know what your life has been like, but I'm sure many of the people who are listening to this show have had things in their life that were just toxic.
Yes.
They did everything they
completely
could. Yes. They absorbed all of the responsibility they could for the things that they could. And yet it didn't work, because there are some toxic individuals in this world. And there's nothing you can do.
Really, yeah. Really, really, really great clarification. I'm so glad you put that in. That is so true.
Yes. That is very true. So I feel, for some people, it'll just never work. But once you've tried and once you realize, hey, it's not me, that's also growth, right? For you to realize that person is just never going to be what I need in my life. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So that would be my second tip.
Okay. Number three.
Number three, dive deeply into your passions, because I believe that people who are like each other find each other like drops of oil in a glass of water. We have no other choice but to find the people who are so much like us. There's actually an effect that we talk about in developmental psychology called the active environment gene interaction. And what that basically means is that you are actively seeking out people in this world who are similar to you genetically. You don't even know you're doing it, but you do it. You find them in friendships. Yes.
Wait, back up. Similar to you genetically?
Genetically. Your genes seek out the people in this world who are actually similar to you genetically. How that manifests when we study it in psychology is as homogamy. So homogamy is the level of similarity between two people in a couple. And the people who have the most homogamy often have the longest relationships. Okay, so homogamy is something good. The reason why they're similar is because they genetically, they are drawn to each other. Like I said, like drops of oil in a glass of water. And think about it. Those oil drops are hard to separate, right? Once you find your people, it's hard to get them out. So dive into your passions. Go to bookstores, go to concerts, learn to play the piano, learn Italian, learn to cook. Whatever it is that you love, do that more. And you are bound to find people who share your interests and passions like this. Actually, you know, I feel this affinity. You and I, again, for everyone who's just tuning in now, we've never met personally, but just the way that you ask questions, your wonder about the world, you and I found each other because we were meant to find each other. Genetically, we share some of the traits that probably will connect us always, right? And we maybe will connect the same kind of people. And that is true because we kind of run in a similar circle on even social media.
Absolutely. Right? Yeah.
So if you believe in this process, then the way to find deeper and more meaningful and more social connections is to just really, really dive deeply into your passions.
Oh my goodness. I love this. I have completely loved this conversation. I do feel like we could keep going on and on and on, but for the sake of this podcast episode, I think we're going to have to wrap it up. And I know that people are going to want to get in touch with you. They can find your book. Currently, it is pre-order on Amazon, Out of Touch, How to Survive an Intimacy Famine. And we're going to put a link to that in the show notes. But if they want to reach out directly to you, Michelle, how do they find you?
Perfect. Yeah. And it's not only on Amazon, anywhere where you buy books, you can. Yeah. It's on sale pretty much anywhere.
It's everywhere. It's everywhere. Yeah. Pre-order. Wait.
That's awesome. Everywhere that I'm surprised about. if they want to reach out, you can reach out to me on Instagram or Twitter at Dr. Michelle Druin in both of those places. And then I'm on Facebook. I mean, all of those places. If you want to send me a direct message, I'm really happy to respond. I'm very committed to seeing others, and that helps me feel seen as well. So I hope that people reach out after this podcast. I hope that something I've said connects with someone and that they, you know, want to share that with me. So I'd be thrilled.
Beautiful. I love it. Love it. Love it. We will put links also to your social networks in the show notes. Michelle, Wonderful. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Jennifer, for having me.
This has been delightful. And everyone, thank you for joining us today. If you want to continue to get tips and resources and tricks on how to transform your trauma into your superpower, click the subscribe button and join the journey. And with that, you guys, we're out. Remember to live well, have fun, and love others. Bye, y'all.
Thank you for joining the journey on this episode of the Being Seen podcast. As a transformational business coach, Jenny Q coaches you on how to get unstuck in your business and thrive in your life, stepping fully into your power, all while having fun. To contact Jenny Q or for more information, jump over to jennyqlive.com.